So I will talk about spin-on deconfinement in ordered Heisenberg antiferromagnet in two dimension. This is a very old system. You know, Heisenberg antiferromagnet has been with us for a long time. We have developed a fair amount of understanding over years, and it's interesting that still there are interesting surprises, and I will discuss one such thing. After a brief introduction, I will talk about excitations that carry spin twist or chirality in ordered Heisenberg antiferromagnets, and those eigen excitations are, you can see them already at a topological level. They are all topological defects or topological twists. They go under the name of skirmions. How, when you quantize them, they become very meaningful excitations, some of them carrying spin half and so on. Then I will talk about the operator that creates such excitations in the quantum antiferromagnet, and I will show you a very close connection of the mathematical property of this operator with Laughlin quasi-particle excitations in quantum Hall effect. And then if I get time, I will discuss a Berry phase calculation, and then towards the end I will discuss the relevance of this problem to high temperature superconductors and some issue about the topological degeneracy. Some of the things that I am going to talk about is there in this CONMAT preprint. Just as a background, spin half excitations in a background of singlets is very easy to visualize. One can write down wave functions, but it turns out it's very difficult to get them in quantum spin problem. They are basically a spin one excitation is unstable and breaks up into two spin half objects. As I said, it's very clear when you look at short range RVB, where you have resonating valence bonds and there is one unpaired spin in the middle. You can put it in some momentum eigenstate. So such wave functions you can write down very easily. Then similarly, in a chiral spin liquid, which is a short range RVB plus, it has an extra component in the sense there is a ground state spin current having some direction, some particular sense of spin current in the ground state. There also you can create these unpaired spins in a very easy way. So these are all when you have a disordered spin liquid state, where it's easy to identify this unpaired spin. The question is, do they make sense once you have an ordered antiferromagnet? The answer is yes, at least in one dimension. I will discuss this in some detail. If you take 1D model with Ising anisotropy, you can create a domain wall or a kink, which basically connects two different ground states. And then since the domain wall is finite, from a distance if you look at it, it would look like a particle. And you can define quantum dynamics for it. It carries spin and it carries mass and so on. Now the challenging question is, are there such higher dimensional objects? And then are there quantum number fractionalization there? Naturally, this is very relevant for cube rates because the parent insulating state has very strong resonating valence bond character plus this long range antiferromagnetic order. So one would like to know how it gets modified once you dope holes in the system, which brings in completely new charge dynamics. This problem that I am going to address is rather old. I will call it as topological search. It started many years back in the work of Wilczek and Zee, that if you look at O3 sigma model in 2 plus 1 dimension, they invented a term, so-called half term, which will make some of the topological excitations to have Fermi statistics depending on the coefficient of the half term. So the notion of skirmion and its meaning started even right at that time. Then along with the discovery of cuprate superconductors, Zhilosinski, Wigman and Polyakov suggested that if you analyze carefully the Heisenberg model in two dimension, there should be a half term in the nonlinear sigma model description, and then this half term should be related to the a spin half object emerging as a topological excitation. Then they speculated ideas which are similar to RVB ideas, namely that when you dope it, that this will become the singlet hole on and so on. Then around the same time, Anderson, Sajeev Jain, Dusso, Leong and myself, we were trying to see how this will fit into nonlinear sigma model description, and we have a preprint which is very old. There we pointed out that if you think of a generalization of domain volume in two dimension, the natural generalizations are vertices. Like, you know, if you have a XY order, you can easily imagine vertices. Then we are focusing on vertices and neurons. Neurons are also some kind of, I'll come to them, solutions of nonlinear sigma model. It turns out both of them are very bad at energies. So for various reasons, we did not pursue that. But however, Sajeev Jain and his group have been pursuing this kind of idea and looking for its relevance for cuprates, particularly we introduce holes. It turns out that we need not look at neurons and vertices, which are larger energy. The good old skirmions themselves are rich enough, and they contain the physics of spinon that we are seeking. So I will just, before I go into the details, I will summarize the result that we are used to looking at the spectrum of a Heisenberg model. As you know, you have the ground state, you have spin one, spin wave, which carries delta z equal to 1, and the usual spin wave dispersion, and they span an energy of 2j. Now, within the continuum approximation that I'm going to discuss, we can't think about textures or long wavelength deformations within the validity of the model, and you find that there are topological distortions of the vacuum, which have finite energy, and they have finite topological quantum numbers, so-called one skirmion, two skirmion, and so on. They have some chirality quantum number, or in terms of RVB theory, can discuss in term flux. And in terms of energies, they are separated by fairly large energy, 2 pi j, 4 pi j, and so on. Now, what I'm going to discuss is that once you quantize these excitations and look inside, actually, this object has all the property of two unbound spinons sitting inside. This is going to be the theme of my talk. So the spectrum of quantum Heisenberg model becomes rich, because what we learn in Kittel is this, that if you look little deeply at higher energies, there are rich spectrum here. There are spinons floating around, which are going to be, which are the precursors of spinons in the spin liquid state, and you can make them by modifying the Hamiltonian appropriately.
So you say these energies scale like J, what about the energy of the
meron? They have logarithmic divergence. If you have two meron and separate them, the energy is logarithmically divergent. So free meron is not very useful. Now, there is a very intimate connection between spin half excitations and the spin twist. And this is very nicely captured in the example that was actually popularized by Van Wilczek and Z. If you take three spin half system, like three spins interacting through antiferromagnetic coupling, you find that the classical ground state is this 120 degree structure. Here the spin is turning clockwise, there the spin is turning counterclockwise. So you cannot connect one ground state to another ground state through global rotation. So they are distinct. Now you can solve this problem quantum mechanically, because the number of states is 2 to the power of 3, which is 6. They decompose into two sets, a spin half manifold, another spin half manifold, and a spin three half set. Now, if you look at the spin half, we have Sz equal to half and minus half, another Sz equal to half minus half. There is another quantum number which distinguishes the two sets of spin half states. This is a Kramer's degeneracy. That is a very simple thing. That is, if you write down the wave function for this, it looks as if there is a downspin which is running around this ring, carrying a momentum pi. So here is a downspin which is running around the ring, carrying a momentum minus pi. So these are all two spins that are running clockwise. So because of the structure of the Hamiltonian, the ground state carries a spin current. Now, if you want to see further property of, for example, is there any property of this 120 degree here, then it turns out that there is an operator called chirality operator, which measures how the spins are twisted. It is centered under rotation in spin space because it is a scalar. However, this object, when you find the eigenvalue of this operator, these are all eigen states of this operator, and it turns out to be plus and minus 1. And this example already illustrates several things. It tells you that even though the classical ground state has no chirality because the spins are planar, if you take the expectation value of this operator, it is 0. But however, quantum fluctuations, you know, when they start quantum fluctuating, it develops chirality. So this is something very interesting already. So there is a very close connection between spin twist and the fact that there is a spin half in the system. And also this tells you that the chirality is related to spin current of an unpaired spin, because if you think about this free spin system, it is tempting to call it as a spin on that is already there in the ground state, because you have three spins, so next spin is half, so it is as if there is an unpaired spin which is running around. So the spin current of that unpaired spin is related to this chirality. I will come back to this little later. But you may use this, for example, if you look at a slightly general model, that you take three spins which are not forming a triangle, which are open ends like this. Then if you solve this problem, you find that there is a unique ground state which has spin half, then there is another spin half state which is somewhere here. Basically what happens is unpaired spin on is forming some kind of standing wave here. So they are not running around, so the degeneracy is lifted up because you have open boundary condition. So if you put proper boundary condition, the degeneracy associated with the spin twist clearly comes out. This is also, okay. Now I mentioned about unpaired spin in one dimension. Let me show this, because this is also related to twist. If you take icing antiferromagnet, for example, small icing anisotropy, the Heisenberg model with the small icing anisotropy, you find that there are two ground states. This is sublattice A, the spins are up, or sublattice B, spins are down, or the other way. So here I have created a defect. Basically, I am changing sublattice A spins from up to down as I pass this particular point. So this is a domain wall. So if you follow the spin, for example, in the same sublattice, you will find in a continuous way, I rotate. By the time I come back, for example, if I put them in the circle, I don't come to the same point. I have to go one more round to come to the same point. So there is a sense in which the spins twist. They can twist in the clockwise or in the counterclockwise. So they correspond to the two degenerate ground state that we saw before also. Now once you quantize this particular theory, it turns out there is an unpaired spin in the ground state, which can be in a current carrying, spin current carrying state, have an angular momentum pi or minus pi. So that also tells you that there is a chirality associated with this. What is interesting is this chirality operator that I defined, even though has built in it some notion of order, but since it is a singlet operator, you can define chirality in a spin liquid state also. This is something that will be very important for us, because we will use ordered state and spin twist there, but at the end we will say that this thing survives in a disordered state also. Okay, so this is a very general introduction. Now, in understanding quantum antiferromagnet, nonlinear sigma model has played a very fundamental role. It has led to very interesting phenomena such as Haldane gap and so on. Difference, the fundamental distinction between even and odd, half integer and integer spin. So in a nonlinear sigma model, basically you identify appropriate spin variables, the sublattice magnetization, and a local net spin. And this is naturally a soft order parameter, because it is this, when there is a Goldstone mode, this freely moves around. Whereas L is a hard vector, massive vector. So you can define such operators with appropriate scaling with respect to the spin and with respect to the lattice parameter. You find there are some nice spin commutation relations. L behaves like the generator for N. And there is some mathematics. But at the end you find in the continuum approximation, in a 1 over S expansion, what you find is there is a very nice Hamiltonian involving spin distortion energy, delta x m square. Then the quantum dynamics coming from the generator of this, the thing that is conjugate of this n vector, which is a vector L, plus an important term. So this is analogous to P, our momentum variable. So this is like a shift in momentum analog of vector potential. So depending on the value of the spin, the momentum of the spin current feels the gradient of the spin. Now you can go from Hamiltonian to Lagrangian, where things become little more familiar. What you have is basically an action involving the spatial derivative of the gradient term and the time derivative with appropriate coefficient, and what look like a vector potential turns into something important, so-called the topological phase or resumen of the 10 term in this particular context, described by Haldane for Heisenberg chain. This is a very important thing. What it does is, since action involves, if I consider the action, it involves integration over time also, it tells you that the spin field as a function of time, that is, you have, for example, at time t equal to 0, you start with some spin configuration. Then it, let's say, time evolves in this particular direction. So n as a function of x and t defines a two-dimensional plane. There you have a spin field. How the spin field maps into order parameter space, because order parameter space is S2. That is, you say that if there is a spin up here, I will put a corresponding point here. If the spin is down somewhere here, I will put the corresponding point here. So you do the mapping. And what this term does is, basically tells you how this continuous map measures how many times the configuration is wound. I will come to this in detail a little later. So it turns out this is a beautiful integer, provided you have all the spins pointing in one direction at the boundary. So this basically counts the winding number of this particular mapping. So 2 pi times s, is where s is the constituent spin of the in the problem. So if this is an integer, this very phase factor can become active or inactive depending on whether you have half integer or integer. That is behind Haldane's spin gap phenomena.
Yeah. Just a comment about terminology, which I think is non-trivial, which is that you refer to this as Wesselmino, but Wesselmino really should be one higher
dimension.
And this is not.
Yeah.
This is just okay. Space-time itself.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Now this is whatever I described is for one dimension, and then when we come to two dimension, the things are a little more complicated, because I did not show the full derivation, that you got this nice topological term coming from individual Berry phase term, but in when you come to two dimension, things do not sum up in the way that we want. This was again discussed in detail by Haldane in the context of nonlinear sigma model, that you generalize the problem to two dimension, you have spatial derivative along the x and y direction, you have time derivative. Then you have this important Berry phase term, which arises from individual spins. And then, so this is the individual spin Berry phase term, which essentially tells you that if you concentrate on a particular spin, draw its space-time trajectory, starting from time 0 to up to t. So you have a periodic boundary condition. Then it describes some closed trajectory and measure the area. And this is basically the Berry phase. Now this minus 1 to the power of n plus n comes from staggering, the anti-ferromagnetic character of the underlying order. So the study of quantum Heisenberg anti-ferromagnet in 2 plus 1 dimension becomes this nonlinear sigma model along with this Berry phase term.
Are you summing over m and n there?
Exactly. So
the first term should also be integrated.
Exactly. See, that shows the... Yeah. I'm not used to action. It should be action, then it should. Yeah. Okay, I will come to this. Now, this nonlinear sigma model, you can actually, forgetting about the Berry phase term, write down Euler-Lagrange equation. And firstly, we will look for time-independent solution. So it's a highly non-trivial equation, because this n vector is always unity, so it's a nonlinear equation. And Belavin and Polyakov, while trying to understand various issues of confinement in O3 nonlinear sigma model in 1 plus 1 dimension, came up with a very beautiful set of solutions for the nonlinear sigma model in Euclidean space, which turns out to be very useful for us in our real space, that is, time independent solution. In order to understand this, you write the n vector in terms of this polar and azimuthal angle. Then you define a new complex variable, the field, that is, at every point x plus y, you define a complex number. which is related in turn to the theta and phi through this particular relation. Actually, this is related to stereographic projection of a sphere onto a plane. It is basically that relation. And Balaban and Palyakov found out, after some manipulation, that the complicated nonlinear equation actually reduces to a simple Cauchy-Riemann condition for the function W. In other words, given a set of boundary conditions, they showed that classical solutions for the nonlinear sigma model, but in our case, time-independent solutions, are simply given by sets of functions W, which is characterized by some n sets of poles and n sets of zeros. So you give any such function, and I will make a corresponding translation to n vector, and it satisfies Euler-Lagrange equation. Now, what are they? It's very simple to, for example, if I choose the case n equal to 1, it has a very simple form. It's a well-known domain wall or a bubble. That is, for example, in this, if you look at infinity my spins are all pointing in one direction. Then as I move radially inward, the spins start, you know, opening out, and then they go down to and point in the opposite direction at the middle. So if you map, as I was telling you before, this two-dimensional spin configuration onto S2, it will exactly cover the order parameter space once, because at infinity all the points are pointing in, so it will touch the north pole. At the middle it will touch the south pole, so any circle in between will map into the corresponding circle, so you will completely cover it once. And I will find it convenient to rotate this entire spin configuration and make infinity to point towards, I will call this as positive x direction. Then the advantage is that I will show that there are two points A and B which corresponds to precisely the positions in the sublattice magnetization where the spin is up and where the spin is down. In other words, if you tell me in the sublattice magnetization where the spin is up and where the spin is down, I can give you the rest of the spin configuration uniquely through Balaban and Palyakov solution. So I will keep using this particular.
What happens is I go from A to B along the blue line?
Yes. If I go from A to B along the blue line, that's basically you move in the great circle. So I said the spins are drawn like this, A to B. So in the order parameter space, if I move along the circle, it's describing a great circle. So this is something very important. Yeah, I'll come to it later. Now, there are also some technical thing which is important, unfortunately. Before that, let me finish some other property of the Skirmion. Now, when you look at Skirmions, they have this property. Then they have non-trivial spin twist associated with them, which is measured by this particular entity, which is called topological density. That is, it measures the local gradient of the spin and takes the curl of this derivatives and then dots with n. And then if you integrate over all space and space, it will give you an n. So this integer uniquely characterizes the Skirmion solution. So you say there is an n Skirmion solution. There is also minus n Skirmion solution because you had a complex parameterization. So if instead of z, you put z bar, it corresponds to another independent solution where the topological density has opposite sign. And what was remarkable was that if you really look at this spin twist, it's very complex. In fact, you can go to mathematics and plot some of them. Whatever you do to the positions A and B, the energy remains invariant. It's a very beautiful set of solutions. So they go through each other like ghosts. There is no change in energy. This is a remarkable property of the scale invariant character of the nonlinear sigma model. So one is tempted to think of this as some kind of particles, because I have defined the space configuration of a spin field uniquely in terms of some positions in real space, A's and B's. So I could as well call them as positions of some particle, and I could try to do quantization. Now there is a very close connection of this topological density, which is derived from the sublattice magnetization idea and the RVB gauge theory idea, that in the RVB theory one introduces, you know, some new variable in terms of the underlying electron operators, which looks like some gauge fields, you know, some like Baumgartner phase factors like this. And Van Wilczek and Zee showed that actually this is related to the spin chirality. So there is a very close connection between the topological density that we see in nonlinear sigma model and the when we see the problem in terms of RVB gauge theory.
This is for the U1 gauge theory. Is there some similar statement for the SU2 gauge theory that people talk about?
Yes, you can put it in the SU2 gauge theory. At the end, only the center of the gauge group matters, and a similar relation survives.
So what about the Z2?
Yeah, for Z2 people also this is fine, because finally this S dot S cross S is plus or minus 1. So that is related to the Z2 variable. Yeah. Now, this is some technical thing, but this is something very important. Those of you who are familiar with skirmions in the context of quantum Hall effect and other problems will see that skirmions characterized in different ways. The popular parameterization of skirmion is in terms of this. So this is also a solution of the Belavin-Polyakov equation. Now you can remove this mu, because mu basically tells you which direction is a in which the spins at infinity are pointing. So by putting mu equal to 0, you will say the spins are pointing along the z direction. So either you can parameterize in this way or this way. Here you put mu equal to 1, which puts the vacuum at infinity along the positive x direction. So that is like fixing the, you know, zero momentum Goldstone bound, freezing that. After that, you have two complex numbers. Here you have a scale parameter, which is not real, it's a complex number, and another position. So conventionally people say that this is, here is a skirmion which has a position A and then whose size is lambda. So everyone always thought that skirmion is one object. But here you see, but one has to remember that this lambda is actually a complex number, so there is, it's not actually a scale, it's something more than that. This becomes very clear in this parameterization, where there are two complex numbers corresponding to two positions. As I said, if you go back and look at the N spin field configuration, at the zero, the spin is pointing along the positive z direction, and at the pole, it is pointing in the negative z direction. So there is something unique within my convention about this point A and B. So this is the approach. I am going to take this parameterization. If you do the solve the problem, we can use this or that. I mean, if you solve the problem completely, but I find it convenient because I'm going to call this A and B as particles shortly.
Do you really have the A in the numerator?
Yes. So zero is at A and pole is at B.
Even though it describes the same W as...
Exactly. We can do a conformal transformation and go between the two. Yeah. Not just a rotation.
Just
an algebraic. Yeah, it is just choosing infinity to be in different direction, but they are identical. If I start working out, I'll make some mistake, but you believe me, this is true.
Feel the same. It's algebraic.
Yeah, just simple. Now, there are two ways of understanding this problem. One is a hard way, which is what people did. For example, this problem was analyzed in great detail by Fatih and collaborators while trying to analyze the effect of instantons and quantum fluctuations about them, and Ding and Zakrevsky in the context of O3 sigma model in order to understand the effect of half term. So then the idea is that if you tell me that this is a classical solution, then the way I will quantize is that I will say that A and B become time independent. I will say they depend on time very slowly, and then I will try to get equations of motion for them, or I will try to get their Lagrangian. So what I will do is I will give an adiabatic time dependence to this, and then substitute in the my expression for the action. So I integrate over all the x and y dependence, leave the time dependence intact. Then I will get in general action, a Lagrangian for the A and B particle is like P dot and, you know, the P square. And then when you do this for this problem, you find it's a very non-trivial object. Because when you really do the integration for this configuration, you find the coefficient alphas in this general kinetic energy term starts depending on the positions A and B. So it's very difficult to do quantization. Apparently, if you want to do quantization on this, this corresponds to quantization in Kahler manifold. So it's a very serious mathematical exercise, which I do not know how to do it. And they have tried and they have not completely solved the problem. But however, for us there is another approach available, which is what we will describe. Because we, along this analysis, you will have to keep the track of the Berry phase term also, if you want to do quantization. Now, people will start worrying about, do Goldstone moles interfere? Because all this adiabatic time dependence assumes there is a gap, there is nothing getting excited as I move things slowly. But here we have low energy Goldstone moles. Now my feeling is, I have some heuristic argument that this will not interfere here because the Goldstone modes do not carry any spin chirality. In some sense they are decoupled from these chiral excitations.
So you mean if you integrate out the spin waves so that they will change the structure
of this? Structure of this.
That's the kind of thing you want.
That's the kind, exactly.
Yeah. Non-local terms.
Yeah, this is for example the worry that Duncan Haldane had when I was talking about it a couple of weeks back.
And you claim that this doesn't happen.
That's right, yeah. I will show it in the next, yeah. Now, I will, since we started with the quantum problem, we need not quantize it again. We will extract the skirmion from the quantum problem itself. So, in order to understand that, there's a small digression. So, let's go back to our spin-half Heisenberg model and then look at it in a representation which is even more friendly than twisting spins. That is, you take a square lattice, suppose you have a spin configuration like this, then you say that if my spin is up, for example, this is one of the spin configuration, if the spin is up, I will say that that site is occupied by zero boson. If the spin is down, I will say there is one boson. So this is a so-called hardcore boson representation. There is a unique connection between Sz equal to half and singly or empty boson subspace. So by hardcore constraint, you eliminate double occupancy, triple occupancy, and so on. So this is a very nice representation. For example, this will tell you simply what is amplitude of finding the down spins in these positions, Zs, in the lattice. And then LCR, it is up spin, it's understood. Now you can write our familiar spin wave ground state, at least a slightly modified version of it, in terms of this hardcore bosons in a way that which is even more transparent. It looks like particles all condense in zero momentum state, like a wave function of helium 4, times a Jastrow factor, which correlates the positions of the downspin particle or the hardcore boson through this factor. Because you have a spin wave with linear dispersion and gapless excitation, this f of z has some asymptotic behavior. Now, if you look at the corresponding Hamiltonian in terms of the hardcore boson, the Hopping term has actually a wrong sign. So that can be corrected, which will give you the so-called Marshall sign convention. In other words, the hardcore bosons will try to condense in pi pi momentum rather than zero momentum. So finally, in this language, the spin wave vacuum is like actually a spin superfluid. It's a very friendly representation. For example, in this representation, if you want to have the spontaneous symmetry breaking with spins pointing along the x direction, positive x direction, then you say that in sublattice I is a linear combination of empty and one boson, and then in site B it's a empty and the one boson with opposite sign. So when you expand it out, you'll get the Marshall sign, and then it'll be coherent superposition with all boson numbers, which is what we need in order to localize the sublattice magnetization along the x direction, because you need to give large fluctuation in total Sz. What I am writing down is that if you give me such a state, I would like to create a skirmion excitation in this particular vacuum, then just from the form of the distortion, you can write down what is the corresponding operator. I will explain the rationale behind writing this. Okay, so I claim that there is an operator which, when acting on a ground state like a spin wave ground state, creates to me in the sublattice magnetization a Skirmion type of twist, and that is given by this operator. Now the Zi's are the positions of the hardcore bosons, and since I am in a paramagnetic state, or in a total Sz equal to zero state, it's equal to half the number of lattice sites, and this remains as of Laughlin quasi-hole and quasi-particle operator that comes in quantum Hall effect. It has identical mathematical structure. In fact, one can rewrite this in a way that is even more transparent, perhaps, in terms of Sz representation. Then I have to take the product over all sites, and then Zs are no more dynamical variable, but simply positions. Then the operator content is contained in this Sz that is sitting here. The way that you see how it arises is very simple. When it acts on, this operator acts on a linear combination like this, it turns a downspin by this coefficient. Now in fact you can take this to the left side, and what you have is you will have some common denominator which you can take outside. That is, every spin suffers a rotation through this complex factor, the upspin going the amplitude coming from the numerator and the downspin amplitude coming from the denominator. So yes,
in the picture of the previous, yeah, we are thinking of the moon state as the superfluid of the hardcore boson.
Yes,
well, just follow that picture a bit more. I have thought that all the topological indications, that state can be understood in terms of what the
Bose fluid. Provided if it were a hardcore Bose fluid, we have actually an SU2 symmetry. Now this is a very important part.
Very manifest in the boson situation.
The way I have written it, it is manifest. But if you go back to the correct spin wave ground state, there are two Goldstone modes. For example, if you have put your sublattice magnetization on the x-ray plane, you can have Goldstone mode this way or out of plane. Now, it is done together which makes into an SU2 superfluid rather than a U1 superfluid. So it is because of this, the usual vertices are not eigen excitations, and the eigen excitations, as given by, you know, the Skirmion solution, is a more complicated distortion. If you force such a vertex distortion, you can force them, then the energy will grow logarithmically with the size of the system. Another way of saying is the following. This is an important question. That is, what will happen to my Skirmion if I were to introduce an X-ray anisotropy in the system? That is, I said that, let me put the... two Skirmion, I have a Skirmion here, then I introduce an X-ray anisotropy in which I make this X-ray component of the exchange coupling slightly larger than the Z component. Then what happens is something very interesting. The point A and B becomes very special. In the sense, if you look at it carefully, there is a large X-ray distortion around this particular point in the XY plane. There is a vertex having lying in the XY plane around here. There is another anti-vertex. Now, if you calculate the energy density, there is something special here. It is larger in this region. Now, if you make the thing isotropic, there is nothing special about this point A and B, because I could have chosen any two diametrically opposite point as my convention. So, the property of the Skirmion is that any point on the vertex, on this circle, defines a vertex, which is perpendicular to the reference direction, but I can rotate that plane continuously as I move around the circle. If I make the system XY anisotropic, two points are chosen depending on in which way I have chosen XY anisotropy. Then the energy becomes logarithmically large as I separate them. So Heisenberg model is something very special, where the two vertices, a vertex and anti-vertex, just manage to remove their logarithmic divergence by appropriate spin twist. Now if I make it Ising anisotropic, which I can go beyond Heisenberg, then what will happen is you develop basically a dislocation in the Ising order, basically connecting the point A and B. So Heisenberg model is pinched by two ends. In one end, this A and B will correspond to tips of line dislocation. So the energy will grow as the size of the system,
linear.
On this side, it will grow as logarithm of the size of the system. And at the Heisenberg point, it is finite. That's a remarkable thing about this Kermion solution.
If I set A and B
infinite,
then along the state around A, you have vortex, right?
Yes.
Does that cause logarithmic
divergence? It does not. That's because if you calculate, that's like an umbrella. The question Wang is asking is that, suppose in my convention, the spin is up here, at infinity it is down. Mm-hmm. Now here it is like a vertex. Suppose I make, let me say this is radius R, which is in my convention A minus B. If I make R tend to infinity, I will have basically one vertex in the entire system. Does it cause logarithmic divergence? The answer is no. Because what happens, it becomes exactly like an umbrella. And the usual logarithmic divergence, there is an 1 over R, which is exactly cancelled by another factor R coming from the fact that as I move inwards, my XY component is decreasing. So logarithmic divergence is taken care of. So Skirmion solution for any separation A and B is finite in energy. That's what I exhibited before. It's a very beautiful thing. It's very counterintuitive, but it happens. Something special about Heisenberg point. Now, having made a connection of this object to Laughlin, so without going the collective quantization procedure, I have constructed an operator which produces precisely this Kermion distortion in my antiferromagnetic order. And now then I can study the property of these operators. Incidentally, if you look at the form of this operator, it's identical to the Skirmion operator that Kalmayer and Laughlin introduced in their chiral spin liquid. It's mathematically identical to that. Of course, they were considering individual poles or zeros because they wanted to produce spin-on. And they had no notion of Skirmion in their work. But however, the mathematical form is identical. Similarly, if you look at Hald and Shastri model in one dimension, that again has the same mathematical model form as the Laughlin quasi-holes. So it's very interesting that Skirmion operator has the same form. So it better describe the same kind of objects, namely spin-ons, which is what I will try to show in the next transparency. Now, having described some entity in terms of some operator, I would like to understand what are they, what are the spin, what are the statistics. Okay. This is a very non-trivial problem, particularly in our context, because of the gapless modes that one talked about before. Now, let me look at the Laughlin quasi-hole operator. What does it do? It actually, if you look at it in terms of the, as a complex number, it has a modulus and it has a phase. That is, it chooses a point A and gives every particle a unit angular momentum about that point. So that means it creates a vertex at the point A, about the point A. So it is a big vertex carrying a lot of angular momentum. Now, because the modulus also vanishes, so it is trying to produce a normal core. That is, it's trying to push the bosons away from the region. So in general, when I create a Laughlin quasi hole, in the quantum Hall effect, there is a charge deficit. So in the same way, here there will be a boson deficit. By measuring the boson deficit, I will be able to see how much spin is carried by this particular entity. Yes?
Quantum Hall effect, the reason that there is a charge deficit of the vortex is because the whole collectivity is quantized.
Right.
And so, in this case, you don't have any system, so what do you expect to have a quantum deficit
of the vortex? Yeah, I will address that precisely, that question. The question that Senthil is asking is that in quantum Hall effect, we know why how these fractions appear. There is the quantized Hall conductance. What is analog the thing here?
That's what guarantees that the vortices are not really distinct. Vortices are the same as the charge carrying holding particles.
Right. Right. Yeah, I understand that. Come to that point. So, basically, since I have a system which is gapless, where I can have very large fluctuation in Sz, because finally it's an ordered state along the x direction, so there is a coherent fluctuation in the particle density, even locally, which is reflected by the fact that there is a Goldstone mode, which is a spin wave. So if I nominally make a measurement of the charge deficit by creating a quasi-hole about the spin wave, what you find is there is some deficit which falls off very slowly as a function of distance, and depending on how you do it, you get a number which is pi, or it is not a very sharp number. It depends on, in fact, I cannot calculate it for arbitrary Jastrow factor, and in some cases I can take care of hardcore repulsion and calculate it. You get a finite number which is not quantized. Then you do the following limiting procedure, which is more like a regularization. Then you find what you expected. But then the question remains that it is still a limiting procedure. So I should try to justify it in a different means, which I will do later. So the way I do it is, yeah.
I'm being a bit confused. So here, the direction of your Neel magnetization is along the x
direction. Right.
So then the so then one would have thought that the only good quantum number was, let's say the spin magnetization was along the x direction, that Sx is the only good spin quantum number that was still
left. Right, so there is a very large fluctuation in Sz.
See?
So it's like I'm trying to find a pin in a haystack.
So in terms of labeling, giving quantum numbers to your excited states, you should be labeling them by their Sx values.
You are right,
But here, so here you're attempting something else. You're attempting to, when you say spin statistics of A and B particles, you don't mean the Sx value of the spin, but rather the
Sz value, exactly, which is large and fluctuating.
Why should I be assigning that quantum number? I know that I can't. It's like trying to label the excitation in a superfluid by the charge density,
right?
Which
is not sharply defined. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. This is a problem. So I will show you how I circumvent it, and in two ways. So let me first do it in. See, the basic problem that Senthil is pointing out is that here you have a system where there is such a large Sz fluctuation. How can you define some object which has a half value? Like in a superconductor, there is a lot of charge fluctuation. Can you define a sharp charge? The answer is no. But let me define a limiting. Fortunately, nature does it for example, in 1D Heisenberg model, where
there is no boundary range magnitude.
There is a critical order, though.
I'm confused.
Yeah.
There seems to be two different spins, right? So there's the spin in the original antiferromagnet.
Right.
But here you're really talking about, when you mean
sublattice magnets.
You really mean the spin of this A particle.
At the end,
you really meant the angular momentum of the A particle, right? I mean, how?
Okay.
And the spin statistics of the A particle really mean divine to change to A particle.
The field angular momentum.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So
okay.
But they're related at some level.
They are related. I'm taking a very simple naive attitude that if I give a static Skirmion configuration and do quantum fluctuation about it, which is what I do when I create with this Laughlin-like operator, then I'm measuring the delta Sz, that is net spin value that I have induced by giving this Kermion configuration.
The average value of the spin.
Average value of the spin. Yeah. Which is what I'm trying to do.
That spin is the same as the spin up there.
Exactly. Yeah. Like in quantum Hall effect also, that before you define in quantum dynamics, you take a vacuum and then define the formal excitation and then measure its local charges.
No, but in the quantum Hall effect, we know that we can indeed label the excitations by charge.
Right. Yeah. So here I will, what I will do is by hand I will produce a gap and start labeling them. At the end I will discuss this. Yeah, that's an important point. So the way that I do it is in the following. That is, I had a wave function which is gapless, you know, which has this Jastrow factor, which is power law and so on. I multiply it by a factor which looks like epsilon times the exponential in Laughlin wave function. Now, there are justifications for this actually. If you look at it carefully, this amounts to, in this way I have done it, putting modulus, introducing SZ anisotropy in the problem. That is, I know that once I introduce SZ anisotropy in the Heisenberg model, it is going to produce a density wave in the hardcore boson. That is the Ising antiferromagnetic order. Okay? And then there is an associated gap in the problem. So if I have small Ising anisotropy, there is for me a gap to hold on to, and I can define things very sharply, which is what I'm trying to do. So I'm introducing an Ising anisotropy through this factor. Then there is a gap, which is correlated to this energy parameter epsilon. So I can measure the boson deficit around A and B. Now, because of the particular form of this, you find that the boson deficit is basically half plus corrections. Now, I mean, if you measure it in a particular volume, and if you make the volume larger and larger, this correction vanish. All this is because I am actually living under a gap, because as Sintil pointed out, once I have a gap, SZ becomes a sharp quantum number, and I can discuss things in terms of that. Yeah.
But with that same Ising anisotropy, energy of this fermion can also become infinite.
So I will not take them apart. I will keep them at finite distance. Yeah, all those complications are there. I mean, then you may ask whether they decay if you wait long enough. I will not wait long enough. So it's a you see the struggle. That is, here is an object which has a very beautiful mathematical property. In some limit, it becomes spin-on, which is very clear. So I'm trying to push its property to the Heisenberg limit.
But the limit is to move away from the Heisenberg model by introducing Ising
anisotropy. Exactly. A little bit. There are two ways of doing it. Here, I have introduced Ising anisotropy. Another way is to have without modulus, which amounts to breaking chirality in the ground state. That is, I, on top of antiferromagnetic order, I produce a chiral twist. This is something similar to when Wilczek and Z did in their analysis of a chiral spin liquid. So which is in the chiral theory, it's like producing a small tiny mass gap. So even then, you have a gap and you have a size for your spin-on, then things can be talked comfortably, then at the end, make that go to infinity.
Let me just make sure I understand this statement about the Heisenberg magnet, some amount of Ising anisotropy.
Yeah.
So there, you don't break the symmetry of rotations about the Z.
Right.
So you can label things with the Z quantum number.
Exactly.
And there, you would say that that model has in its spectrum gap Z equals half excitation. So that is taken to mean.
Whenever A and B have finite separation, if you make A and B to a very long distance, this corresponds to an excitation which energy scales with the distance between the two particles.
So then one would say the spin-ons are actually confined in that model.
Precisely, exactly. So they are confined in an Ising model, and they are also confined in a Heisenberg, in a X-ray model, and in between they are deconfined. So I am simply approaching...
And you're going to give arguments for that.
Right, exactly, yeah.
See, another way of saying Senhill's worry is to say that, isn't it a more mathematical way of saying that, is that if you introduce this anisotropy, then the mathematics of Belyaev and Polyakov would not go through, right? All kinds of
yes, that's very. What happens is you don't have analytical solutions, but there is some stability of the whole solutions, so which can be numerically checked.
Okay, so you think that there's a regime?
Exactly, yeah. In fact, that has been checked also. People studying Belavin-Polyakov for some anisotropy cases.
Mm-hmm.
You can numerically, unfortunately, the elegant analytic solution exists only at Heisenbergian. Yeah, you are happy with that. So, two things happen. One is the boson deficit is half. So you can identify this with the spin-on. Then another interesting thing is, by the same argument, that the exchange statistics is half actually. If you exchange A and A particle, you get plus pi by 2. If you exchange B and B, you'll get minus pi by 2, and so on.
Mm-hmm. So that's how you preserve time.
Exactly.
Semions and
anti-semions. Yeah, anti-semion. See, here what you have done is, in this excitation, we have spontaneously created a kind of magnetic field in the ground state by creating these two particles. A, for example, if I create two particles, A1 and A2, I can get it from two skirmion. So I have given a twist, I have spontaneously generated magnetic field. Now, these two objects in this magnetic field behave as if they are semions in a particular sense. So, if, yeah.
Is it true that you can only talk about statistics and so on, and you can take those partners arbitrarily far away?
Between friends, we can talk about them. Yeah, we know the limitations, right?
No, yeah. Large comparison.
See, even experimental friends will agree that the sizes are not, the samples are not infinity. No. These days, they're talking about micron size samples and so on. In a place, yeah.
No,
you are right that if I have some object which has no shape, no size, what is the meaning of exchanging them? Like exchanging two big clouds.
No, I'm just worried about talking about statistics of these within quotes, spin-ons and so on, in a case in which they don't really exist, like the sense that they are confined.
No, so my whole point is,
the object is not really there in the spectrum.
I don't know what you mean by that. I have shown you that there exists an operator which creates a finite energy excitation.
No.
Do you agree with that?
Heisenberg limit,
yeah.
No, I'm just trying to understand the Heisenberg limit first.
Okay, in the Heisenberg limit, you are right that if I make A and B go to infinity, this excitation becomes too massive. The energy is of the size of... Exactly. So, conveniently, I will keep them at a finite separation and then discuss this, whatever I am doing, exchange and so on. I will not allow them to, otherwise then the strings will break, yeah. Yeah. So now let me summarize the content of whatever. How much time do I have?
Okay.
So what I have shown is that if you analyze carefully the skirmion excitation, you can indeed quantize them, you can make them genuine quantum excitation in the sense around this quantum configuration, classical configuration, there are quantum fluctuations, and then it behaves like two independent particles, of course infinitely fat particles. So in some limiting cases you can define, in a limiting fashion you can define spins to them, and they have some funny property. So I'm going to call them as spin-ons, which becomes rather well-defined if you break chiral symmetry, or if you go into a short-range RVB state, or if you go into an Ising state with some finite distances. Now, yeah.
So you do have a string charge separation at halfway.
Yes, okay. The charge is a, I will come to the question of charge towards the end, yeah. That's an important question. Now, if what I have said is true, I should be able to get it out of the Haldane's Berry phase also. Because this is the thing that, I will very quickly go through this. Having produced, yeah.
Then before you go through this technical thing, perhaps you could just tell us what you are hoping to infer from the statements about the XY and Ising limits, from understanding that to the implications of Heisenberg.
Okay, so I am going off from Heisenberg limit in order to make these objects A and B have some sharp meaning within some distance.
Short distances.
Yeah. So having done that, I move back to Heisenberg model. When I say that in this limit, my A and B particles are spinons, even though they have become infinitely fat, they carry spin half quantum number.
But are they still going to be linearly confined? Or
they are not. Okay, if you sit at the Heisenberg model, as I told, okay, that is, if I sit at the Heisenberg model and then do quantum fluctuations about the Skirmion solution, you find the following interesting result. Yeah, thanks for reminding. That is, I have produced a Skirmion and I told you that as a function of A and B separation, there is no energy change. So these particles don't see each other at all. Then what about quantum fluctuation? Because once I create a big spin distortion, the nature of zero point energy changes, quantum fluctuation changes. So in principle, you could have a quantum correction. How do I calculate it? I go to my usual vacuum and sum up the zero point energy. Then I sum up the zero point energy in the presence of a Skirmion with the A and B particles at these two points. And whatever difference is there, that will actually correspond to the quantum correction energy. It's like a Casimir effect. That is, I have distorted the vacuum, there is a small change in zero point energy. That is what it is. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not worried about the energy of the Skirmion as such. Rather, what quantum numbers you are, what spin quantum numbers you are assigning.
I will continue to assign whatever it was there starting in the limit Ising tends to zero. That is zero plus.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But then that's somewhat
pathological, yeah.
No. So if you approach the Heisenberg point by starting with Ising anisotropy and decreasing the Ising anisotropy to zero,
yeah,
then you naturally select the ground state and with magnetization
is pointing one direction.
Pointing along, say, the direction of the original Ising anisotropy.
Yeah.
Okay, so then let's say that's along the whatever direction, the X or Z, let's say it's the X direction. Then you would say that the Skirmion has SX quantum number equal to a half. Is that right? Is that the statement you want to make?
Yes, which I can accommodate by a global rotation.
Then once you fix the direction of the
with respect to
magnetization, you no longer have any freedom.
I agree.
Apart from rotation, the both the direction of the negative magnetization.
So my convention is, with respect to the ordering at infinity, the SZ is in the opposite direction, is in the normal direction. If at spin infinity the spins are pointing along the X direction,
right,
then the spin associated with the spinon is having delta SZ equal to half.
But again, SZ as opposed to SX.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, we can discuss this point in detail.
You know that somehow you want to let the anisotropy go to zero.
At the same time, yeah.
But one's got to pick some direction for that.
Yes.
And if you pick the X direction, then you're stuck with the antiferromagnet selecting that axis. And now you want to quantize in another direction.
I should think about it.
But your statement is somehow the spinons, you feel, will be there.
I'm not being sharp, sorry, with respect to the direction. I am out of phase by pi by 2. I will think about it and make it clear later. I see the point. Yeah, I have to. So this is another interesting thing, that when you look at quantum corrections, the spinons, the A and B particle actually ripple. They would like to be farther apart. And in fact, the classical energy of this Skirmion is drastically reduced from 4 pi j to 2 pi j. When you look at the analysis, there are some very interesting further energy reduction, because I have created Skirmion by keeping A and B particle farther apart, so that it's very meaningful and the any distortion that you have is a long wavelength distortion. But however, one can ask the question, what happens when A and B become small, the size comparable to the lattice parameter? Then nonlinear sigma model is no more a good description. And then it turns out you can do some perturbation theory. What you find is this Skirmion energy gets further strongly reduced from 2 pi j to even lower value. So it is not a result. Already there is an indication that the Skirmions become much softer when you go to the Brillouin zone boundary, and some of the excited, the high momentum spin waves actually could be already having the structure of the Skirmion. this is something still work under progress. Now you can get all these results, whatever I was saying, sitting exactly at half filling, in even a more mathematically inelegant fashion, but let me show it anyway. That is, there are, if you give me a classical configuration and ask what is the spin content of that, the procedure to calculate the spin is to give that field configuration a collective rotation, say about infinity, and then accumulate and find out what is the net Berry phase that you get. If the net Berry phase that you get is 2 pi times m sigma, and you say that sigma is the spin of that topological configuration. This is the prescription that you get when you look at path integral or analysis of wave function. So for that, we have to look at the sum of Berry phases from all the lattice, and Haldane devised a scheme for doing this for skirmions in the context of a search for half term in quantum Heisenberg antiferromagnet. Now I simply use that scheme and analyze it for our skirmion problem. Find the following interesting result, that if I have a skirmion with position A and B here, I sum up the Berry phase, all the Berry phase coming from individual chains are trivial, except for a chain that passes through the point A and B. This gives me a phase of pi on the left side and plus pi, minus pi on the right side, and then the other chain give me identically zero. So telling there is something special about a half line going to infinity, starting from the origin and passing through my A particle. Similarly, another half line starting from the origin and going to through my B particle and going to infinity. So as you analyze the Berry phase, you get two pieces, one a pi, another is a minus pi. The way it happens is very non-trivial. This is where the interesting thing, the topological property comes. That is, as I analyze the contribution from various chains that are away from this A and B particle, thus the space-time evolution of the spin configuration attempts to wrap the sphere completely, but it always leaves a hole. And that amount of hole depends on how far I am from the line that passes through A and B. So exactly for that line, the hole goes to zero, saying that for this particular singular line, the order parameter space is wrapped once clockwise, once this way completely, and another time in the opposite direction completely, giving me the phase that I am looking for. And what is even more interesting is that whatever way you organize the spins in the problem, the sum, that is, you can group the spins in many, many ways, there is always one singular chain which behaves in the way that I said. It gives you a value of pi and minus pi. For example, you can choose this particular circle itself to be the singular chain. As I pointed out earlier, this means the spin configuration will go on the great circle, so it will wrap the sphere completely once in one sense and another in another sense, giving you a pi and minus pi. That means your spinon coming from this one-dimensional chain is embedded in the skirmion configuration in a very degenerate way. You cannot escape it. It is always there, so it is irreducible in some sense. So this is the other proof for the fact it's a Spinhoff object. Incidentally, if you look at the Spinhoff, how Spinhoff quantum number is gotten for antiferromagnet in one dimension, the analysis is very similar. It's like analyzing one of these chains.
It means that it must be moving along that line.
Exactly. It's, when you quantize it in the quantum, it's just delocalized along that line. Even though I have said that its position is A and B, it's like a Mobius strip. In fact, if you take a 1D Heisenberg chain in a closed chain, and then have an odd spin, then the ground state has a twist which is uniformly distributed along this chain. So it's like a Mobius strip. Now once it is uniformly distributed, you cannot say where the twist is, because local twist everywhere it is constant. So you can pre-assign one point to be at some reference point and then call it as a particle. It turns out to be something very similar to that.
So the spin has to be perpendicular to that line.
Which is in this direction. Yeah, right. That's the way it is coming up.
As we have discussed, it's always worrisome, that you get this kind of topological effect, which is strictly a global long distance kind of thing, out of something that depends so much on the short distance lattice variable.
The because finally an odd spin
right.
is a lattice. So, you see, a spin of object is odd. You know, it cannot come globally. It is finally an electron tied to an atom.
Right. So in the there's a natural question about whether it's independent of the short distance regularization or you regularize in a different way.
Right. So in this problem, one has to be very careful. That is what it tells. That, in fact, Phil, for example, feels this entire O3 sigma model description is not correct. We have to go to SO3 in order to capture that possibility correctly.
To what? To SO3?
SO3. We can discuss it later, right? Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's your the old paper that we wrote together. Okay, now I'll quickly summarize. So, having found these A and B particles, let's see what are their meaning. They are interesting objects, actually. They can be useful also. So, if I identify A and B to be spin-ons, they carry a spin half, it can be up and down, and it has carry a chirality, so it can be plus and minus one. So, spin-on actually carries a chirality with it. I will call it for the sake of Senthil, I will call it as a pi flux. It's a Z2 vertex attached to this. Spin waves actually are non-chiral objects. So they are, in some sense, spin one object bound state of A and A bar or B and B bar. Now, one can push it further and I can construct, charge this A particle with an electron and actually make it a spin singlet and charge E and chirality minus one and plus one. So it tells you that the physics of the chirality is very intimately tied with spin-on. At least it is transparent in this particular picture. In fact, in many of the pictures that Wang is developing, very similar thing is happening. So I think that's what I wanted to say. And there is something about topological degeneracy. Maybe I will discuss if there is any question. So naturally, this has application. I will include this. That is, it suggests you a way of doping the Mott insulator. And then one can discuss short-range RVB as skirmion condensation, that if both type of skirmions condensed with equal density, it's non-chiral short-range RVB. If one is more than the other, then it becomes chiral. And there are very interesting anomalies in neutron, infrared, and Raman scattering. Hopefully, some of these things can be used to understand those anomalies. Then there has been a lot of work on quantum Hall skirmion. Where again, skirmion is thought of as one particular object. But if you give this two-particle parameterization, that leads to some interesting possibility even in quantum Hall skirmion, namely possibility of half charge excitations in those systems. Thank you.